Les colloques du Collège de France.
We have today four outstanding developmental scientists. Our first speaker is Bruce McCandless. Bruce is a professor at the Stanford University. He did his PhD in the Oregon University under the supervision of Michael Posner. And in between the several interesting line of research, one of the most interesting for us is the role of the education in the brain, the relationship between education and the brain. Indeed, he is currently leading the Educational Neuroscience Initiative at the Stanford University, where the objective is to study whether the educational experiences can affect the brain organization. So he will present his talk today.
Well, thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here. I first want to just express my kind of wonder and awe that I'm standing here today, 30 years after being kind of a self-doubting, wandering graduate student at the University of Oregon, and ran into a Mike Posner who convinced me at a really gut level that we are living in a generation like no other. We can actually use the tools of neuroimaging to study the things that we might care about most in terms of our psychological lives. And at that time, I also met an amazing postdoc that he recruited from France, who, Stan Dehane, became a really good friend of mine. And we had we both grew up kind of like underneath the sort of belief system of Mike Posner and some of his inspirational ideas and creativity, and this feeling that if we can pursue these ideas, even though we might not know exactly how to get there, these things will advance really rapidly and we can take on really dramatic things. Throughout the years, I've had a wonderful time. Stan has been a major milestones in my life, and we've had many amazing dinners that seem to go on for hours, in which it's fantastic, delightful chance to have you as a friend and as an inspirational figure in the field. So what I want to talk about today is kind of my sense of wonder and awe about where we are right now at Stanford University. We are, and the field in general, we are now really able to make a meaningful connection between educational processes that give rise to the educated mind and neural processes and connect these in a really powerful way. I am running it's called the Stanford Educational Neuroscience Initiative, in which we are bringing together these in a number of different ways at both a national level as well as a local level. We are trying to understand fundamentally the transitions that are changing in the mind and brain as children go from late childhood through early adolescence. This is a phase that isn't really captured by the canons of developmental psychology of early childhood or adolescence. It's this in-between state that Freud called the latency phase, where not much was going on. But we actually know that within the brain, there's a tremendous amount of change that's happening at a systems level. The brain's being reorganized, the child's discovering new capacities, new abilities, new affordances to use their mind in various ways. And pivotal to these are two things that Stan and I have been talking about for a very long time. How we are able to use visual word forms to engage in reading comprehension, and how we're able to refine our number concepts to engage in mathematical reasoning. And I'll be talking about these two things to the extent that I have time, hopefully both of them. But the big question I want to address, I think, is a challenging one for our field that, for which almost none of us have had any training. Education is a deeply mysterious topic. It's a very strange place for us to think about. It's hard for us to get our minds around it. So we face this challenge of how are we going to link functional brain development to the school contexts that give rise to them? This is a really challenging problem. I don't think that we can do it on our own. I think we have to take a radically interdisciplinary approach. And Stanford is a place that really engenders that. There are sociologists at Stanford that are doing amazing things with big data in order to actually quantify education as it's unfolding year by year in the United States. Sean Reardon and colleagues have become the repository for every single state-mandated test that the government insists that every child in the U.S. take every single year from third through eighth grade. This is all compiled into the Stanford Educational Data Archive, and we can see a functional map of the entire nation and how it's changing in these core brain and cognitive developments that we're trying to engender that we think are the root of our civilization. Now, when we study this, we can learn a lot about schools as an entity. Schools are, you can think of them as like a delta function. They consistently have an effect on a small population of kids that you can study objectively over and over again. We can collect objective data on every single school in the entire country and interrogate that and use that as a context for understanding the kind of changes that are happening in these core kind of changes that occur within education. Now, one very staggering thing that we, I think, sometimes turn a blind eye to, or we don't really see from our local context, is that in the United States, one of the biggest factors that's impacting education is a parent's socioeconomic status. There are large disparities, not just in how much income people make or what occupation they have, but the kind of experiences that their children receive when they go to school. And so if you take every single school within the country and you sort of plot it on this axis, you can convert all of the data in the entire nation to a grade point equivalence. And then you can see there's a dramatic impact of sort of family indicators, the socioeconomic status, that runs throughout the entire continuum, which also means that if you can kind of interrogate one particular school, there are some children going to school in Northeast Middle Missouri that are 3.1 grade levels behind the national average in third to eighth grade. And there are other kids, same age and most likely the same kind of phenotype in biology, that are going to school in Joaquin Miller Middle in California. The average of the entire school is 5 grade levels ahead of the rest of the nation. So it's not just a tale of two cities, it's a tale of really big extremes. So education is happening in radically different contexts, and we have to sort of take that into account when we try to think about, you know, how do we put this in context. We are trying to also use big data by taking a very ambitious crosswalk between, you know, the largest data set that we have in the country for looking at educational achievement, together with the largest adolescent brain cognitive development study that's ever been attempted. The ambitious network of 21 different sites have together collaborated to collect 10,000 brain scans on third graders and then continue to scan them every 2 years across their development. We've been able to make a crosswalk between these two to start to ask, is there a relationship between the context that kids are growing up in and the brain development that we see? And I don't want to give a long lecture on this, but one early finding that's come out of our group, you can go read about it for the details, but there are white matter tracts in the brain that are particularly involved in these neuronal recycling processes that are impacted by education, and they're changing dynamically with their environment. And these white matter tracts, when we look at them, seem to be heavily linked not just to a parent's SES or the neighborhood indicators, but one of the largest moderators of this is local school environment. And when we take advantage of the longitudinal aspect of this data set, we can see how is each individual child's brain changing according to their own baseline over time in these different environments? And when we contrast that, we see that children who are in schools that achieve above average sort of educational attainment are showing a very, very different growth trajectory of these left arcuate fasciculus white matter tracts than schools that are showing a below average. So there's indication that these two levels of discipline, of like the sociology of education, big data, and the sort of neuroscience at sort of a large population level, are starting to make some contact with each other. These are correlation evidence, so we have to really take that in mind when not jumping to any sort of causal thing. But one thing that we are seeing, which is kind of a surprise, is that some environmental variables that we thought were just additive in terms of their adversity are actually loading differentially on different white matter tracts in the brain. And we think that that might be an important avenue to explore in the future. The other thing that I'm doing is not just thinking, you know, globally, but acting locally. We've started some really bold initiatives where we are actually trying to bring neuroscience into an in situ school and classroom and integrate it into everything that schools are doing so that children can start to experience, like seeing their own brainwaves. They can grow up in a school in which they're watching their brainwaves change dynamically as they engage in learning week to week and year to year. And we've created this partnership that we call the Brainwave Learning Center at Stanford University together with Synapse School. And you all are likely, you're welcome to visit. It's becoming a model for people coming all over the world to kind of check out like what this looks like when you actually bring electrophysiology into schools and interact with teachers and collaborate. Some of our goals are to sort of explain how brain activity is transformed through learning experiences. We can set up causal models. We can also try to inspire a sense of awe and wonder around how our brains are changing with learning. If every student could feel that buzz that Stan Dehane and I had 30 years ago talking to Mike Posner, education might feel quite different. So we're also carrying out science experiments. So one of the things, the big sort of guiding principles that we had was to say, let's collaborate with teachers and say, you know, students are learning in the brain at multiple levels simultaneously, and we can interrogate how the brain is learning in this hierarchical fashion, not just in what you can report sort of on your test. So we share with them these models that suggest that, you know, kids are continuing to develop in terms of how their brains are processing things at a very low level. They are learning new culturally specific templates for letters. They're learning powerful ways to combine these letters, exploring the affordances of how these letters can be combined to form language forms that they can use, and they're building an enormous token vocabulary of very specific, holistic lexical items that they are using and are tied to their educational success. We wanted to set up a research program in which we could explore these different levels of hierarchy together with the school and the teachers. And the way we do this is through a technique that called steady state visual evoked potentials. So what it looks like is we have a child with a high density array sitting inside what used to be a janitor's closet, but now it's been converted into our lab. It looks really nice. And we're recording their brain waves, and they are simply watching a 3 hertz stimulation, an exact 3 hertz stimulation, an oscillation that we chose that we're giving to the brain. And what we see is that nearly every single child in the school will produce an oscillation in their brain waves that matches that frequency specifically together with harmonics. We can study those. We can start to see how they change. We can also use clever techniques to start to quantify for each individual kid what we're learning about their brain waves. So if you can induce a physical 3 hertz wave precisely in every child's brain just by looking at word forms, one of the things that you can do is start to look at the cortical latency, the eye-mind lag, if you will, overall. And we just this has just been accepted for publication in Developmental Cognitive Neuroscience. I think you'll be able to see the preprint soon. And essentially what we're able to do is use these oscillatory techniques in order to encode not just the amplitude of the signal that is being induced in the brain, but also really precisely the phase, the delay between the screen and the mind. And we see that it's about 170 milliseconds. And people who know my work might think that's one of my favorite numbers in sort of chronometrics and neuroscience for visual word form processes. But if we could measure this precisely within each child, within just like a couple of minutes of, you know, them playing along with the screen, we would have the ability to start to look at how individual differences play out, how these change over development, so third through eighth grade, as kids gain this fluency in their reading. And we'd be able to start to examine changes that are occurring in these cortical networks. It turns out that this is an incredibly reliable way in a very short amount of time to get quantifiable data on every single human brain that's in the school. And the test-retest reliability is quite staggering, but then if you think about the numbers that go into it, it's quite robust. We show that this estimate of cortical latency is internally consistent. It predicts word reading fluency. It predicts overall reading comprehension fluency. It relates to ecologically valid text reading fluency measures that the teachers use, and it's also changing in a year-by-year fashion, more driven by expertise. So we've been exploring this and seeing how is it that this little cortical latency in the mind is explaining so much variance in how well children engage in fluent reading. And we've been exploring this in various ways. We're looking at these brain behavior correlations that are quite robust inside the school. We're relating them, seeing how comprehension speed is mediated by the ability to predict comprehension speed by the latency is mediated by your fluency with identifying individual words. So we think this is the action of the visual word form system overall in terms of its fluency. We also have other techniques that we can use in order to isolate very particular layers. So we can set up an oscillation between two layers by presenting contrasting stimuli that either simply take advantage of a collection of letters that are not known into a word together with, or a word that they recognize. And we can, by oscillating between these two, we can induce a psychological oscillation between whole words that you know and whole words and letter combinations that you don't know. And we can also examine this at a lower level by presenting streams of collections of letters that are not sort of well organized, or collections of letters that take advantage of the statistical properties that you've extracted through your experience. Children are learning both at the word structure level as well as the lexical level. They're building up a huge visual lexicon, but some kids are also building tremendous insights into the statistical structure by which these parts form these wholes. So if you look again, you might see what this oddball sort of looks like. You might see like an oddball popping out. This is not a sensory oddball. This is a psychological oddball caused by your expertise as a reader. The fact that you went to school is producing a 1 hertz oscillation in your brain if you're noticing that once a second something's changing psychologically from one state to the next. We can measure this even in very young kindergartners. We can measure it in third graders. We can measure it in, we did a study in which we measured it from kindergarten through third grade. And we found that the topography and the signal seems to emerge for the structural effect, not in the lowest readers or the earliest readers, but somewhere in the middle of reading performance, and then seems to grow with expertise. We can also study not just how this differentiates people on a bell curve, which teachers find the least informative or the least action-oriented, but what they really want to know is how is a child responding to their learning environment? How are they changing over time, week by week, year by year, in terms of the learning curve? The fact that these measures are so precise gives us insight into the potential of looking at how these change within each individual child as they go through school in a year-by-year fashion. How are kids training up their neural circuitry to take advantage of the statistical properties that we know embody expert word recognition? What we see is that if we measure kids early on in kindergarten, first, second grade, and then bring them back 1 or 2 years later, the amplitude of this signal doubles in size. It's a really dramatic effect. It's also quite reliable and quite precise, which means that we can engage in something that I think is a very special kind of science. It's a science that backgrounds the intercept and focuses on the change within an individual. How is the individual changing in terms of their psychological function in school, and how is their brain changing in terms of its response properties? We can start to look at these growth-to-growth relationships and start to see new insights into how children are changing in the face of their educational environments. We can also look at higher order structures. If we expand upon this, many theorists of reading believe that children build these hierarchical units of onsets and rhymes. So every syllable that you know is probably made up of an onset, some beginning of the thing, and then a rhyme unit at the end, and you become a master of a collection of these things that help you with reading, especially in English. We can set up an oddball at the syntactic level, in which we present exactly the same onset and rhyme units, but we change the order in which they appear. And this produces large violations in the orthographic system that we can use to study the same process that I just showed you a second ago. So 80 onsets, 500 rhymes, it might make 40,000 possibilities, but you might only know about 5,000 of them. Rhyme onset combinations form almost no words that you know. So when we do this, we see that really powerful relationship between how well kids have mastered or internalized the statistical structure of the parts making the wholes within the visual word system, and how well they're doing on an overall task which involves comprehending a list of sentences and being held accountable that you understood each and every one. So this is a very, very high level relationship between something very low level and something, you know, that teachers can recognize, and teachers can start to see the connections with the brain. We think that this is also helping us understand differences that kids have in orthography, demanding tasks such as spelling. And these things have a mediating relationship. It's not just they're all correlation soup. It's there's a distinct contribution of each of them. So we can also do really fun things with teachers. So teachers get really excited about the fact that as they interact with children, they introduce new ideas and they introduce new words that the kids might learn in their class and keep the rest of their lives and change the way what they can think and how they think about a particular topic. So we can use that same technique of presenting specific words among pseudo words, and we can collaborate with teachers now to engage in randomized controlled trials to look at the causal impact of a teacher deciding to teach a particular vocabulary set. And so we have these two-week learning sprints that we've developed in the culture of the school. They love this. They get together, we plan the whole thing, and then the kids all go out on this two-week learning sprint. They try to learn as much as they can during that sprint. They collaborate with us about the best way. And we're able to engage with them to take 60 really, really low-frequency words. They show up in corpora of children's books, less than one part per million, and randomly assign them to three different teachers, and then look at the impact of a child seeing a word from their own class versus somebody else's, another's class. And what we see is that over the course of just 2 weeks, we can see the causal impact of that teaching act that happened within that classroom, the experience they had with their peers and their teacher, changing the brain response that they have to these learned words. And we can put this in the context for people who are interested of, we're using the same technique to look at frequency tagging. Your brain has a different response if you see a word that you've seen many times versus you only see once in a while. This kind of frequency tagging is a very powerful phenomena. And it seems that these words the kids are learning over the course of the 2 weeks look a lot like high-frequency words that they see in children's books. So we have this ability to sort of look at learning across the visual hierarchy within the context of school. And this is largely inspired by, you know, the work that Mike Posner did, that Stan Dehane did, to say that we can make meaningful distinctions in the hierarchical nature in which the brain represents information and learns information, to start looking at educational effects at each one of these levels. Now, inspired by this particular conference, I wanted to talk about something that I never thought I would be studying, but I think I blame Stan for this. I think you put some kind of bug in my head. I asked Stan to give me a number comparison task over and over and over again as a graduate student, because I just didn't believe that I couldn't decide to hit this button for 1 and 5 and this button for 6 and 9 without having the magnitude influencing me. But again and again and again, you convinced me that this was such a powerful relationship. So Stanley Jevons in Nature, many people know this quite well. When you really look at the text, he's asking a really big question, one of the biggest, most fundamental questions in math about how many exactly. And how many objects can the mind comprehend and count instantaneously by a single act of mental attention? And now, in the intro to this, I thought it was really fascinating. It was beautifully written. He writes like a philosopher almost. He cites philosophers like Hamilton. He says Hamilton sums it up, what we know about it, pretty well. The mind can only comprehend a small number of objects, for instance, 3 or 4, by a single act of attention. But then Hamilton goes on to say, however, if you group them into 2s or 3s, you can comprehend as many as you can units, because the mind considers groups as unit if you use them as wholes. Now, this was the intro to this really foundational paper to our whole field, but the interesting thing is this sort of pronominal effect. So Jevons goes on to now say, the subject seemed to me worthy of systematic investigation. But what he meant by the subject was this subject here. How many objects can the mind comprehend? And he completely neglected what I thought was really potentially very critically important to education when you talk to teachers. This may be where all the action is, rather than this. So
I did a little study. I think Ed was around when we kind of conceived of this with Mina Hanala and others, in which we just decided to sort of test this, but now test it with reaction time by looking at voice onset time. So stimulus comes up, you blurt out a word in your natural language, and then we look at the time it took you. This puts things in the reaction time domain that Posner sort of trained us in, how to really use this really quite powerfully. And then we can contrast these different cases. And so if you just blurt out as quickly as you can, how many? What? Nice and loud. Okay. So we did this with first graders and second graders and third graders and fourth graders and fifth graders in New York City, and they loved the task. They thought it was really cool. I think they loved the contingency. When they said the word, that the stimulus disappeared, they almost like they were forced controlling it with their voice. But we found these really powerful relationships in first graders of subitizing range and counting range, and we were trying to quantify the slope to think like, huh, I wonder if the slope is changing systematically with educational context and learning. When we did it with a cross-sectional group of second graders, we got sort of the same thing. Subitizing didn't really change much, but wow, counting slope is changing. Third graders, well, they kind of look like second graders. Fourth graders, fifth graders, they seem to be more and more advanced approaching this adult level. It turns out none of this has any utility at all at predicting their math. We really didn't see any correlations at all. However, when we looked at these situations, these very interesting test cases, we found that they correlated quite beautifully with their math fluency. And we were kind of curious about that. And when we plotted these in these graphs, we had this notion that you might be able to see some configurations like this in a single instance of the mind, kind of like subitizing. So we sort of extrapolated the subitizing slope and plotted these and said, well, for first graders, there's a huge benefit, but they're quite far off the mark of what you might expect by subitizing. And when we look at the residual for nine, we see that it kind of improves by second grade. By third grade, we think we're kind of hitting the mark, and by fourth and fifth grade, it's really sort of dead on. It's as if they're subitizing this this quantity, and the set size effect is shallowing down to the subitizing range. We decided to take this to a next level, not just studying particular odd number cases, because we didn't want to do a science of odd number cases. We wanted to see if we could come up with some principled notion that we could extend across multiple sets so that we could study the set size. So we came up with this manipulation that I don't think is required, I don't think it's necessary, but we did it just for this purpose of being able to explore set sizes in a fair way, where we presented three groups of subitizable items. And we put it in a little task because we wanted to have really young kids do it. So we put it inside this little fun task in which your task is to do something exact. You have to tell me exactly how many pieces of fish food are going into this thing because I have to label it and we're going to sell it to people. And if they give the wrong amount of fish food, the fish is not going to feel very well. So it has to be exact. And they kind of like this. So every time they said we would put the number on the bottle. What we showed is pretty much the same thing, but surprisingly, kindergartners, when we went this young, showed really no significant evidence of benefiting from the three groups. And the grouping effect seemed to get stronger and stronger as they went towards third grade. And when we looked at the relationship to their math fluency, we found that even when we sort of put in all of the things you might expect from our current knowledge of the number world and number cognition to predict a kid's math scores, there was something missing, and this something missing we decided to call groupitizing. It was kind of like subitizing groups, so we kind of mashed that together into a new word, and people seemed to like it because it's got published now in like multiple paper titles, and it's on the edge of being in the dictionary, but when we look at the set size effects, though, it's kind of interesting how it plays out. We've got kindergartners showing a big set size effect, but no benefit of grouping at any of the set sizes, and first graders starting to emerge, second graders and third graders starting to sort of show this kind of effect emerging, and then the grouping slope seemed to have reducing the set size effect. So now the question becomes, well, is this relevant just to like early education, or is this relevant to education writ large, much longer forms of education? And does it become more or less relevant with math? And so we decided to do something that was kind of counterintuitive. We started to give it to older students, third grade through eighth grade. They all knew how to count. They all knew how to subitize. They supposedly wouldn't really relate to how they're doing in pre-algebra or algebraic reasoning or geometry. We had a really nice sample of 1,200 third through eighth graders in San Jose in Santa Clara County. This school is doing quite well if you put it in the context of the overall map that I showed you. And Our question was, could we account for state-mandated assessments of math achievement writ large with this tiny little psychophysical test? And what we found was kind of astonishing, that even in this older group, we're predicting their performance on a state-mandated test using groupitizing, but then the tiny little experimental manipulation kills the effect entirely. And so we found that quite compelling. It's kind of a cross between correlational research and experimental manipulation, showing like huge kind of sort of discontinuities in the data. When we put the other sort of factors in, we discovered something really interesting, that groupitizing was actually the strongest nominal predictor of their global math achievement, even though the test only lasts about 3 minutes and has a whole bunch of little repeated trials. And that was quite dramatic. So we decided to explore the set size effect, the grade level effect. And we saw this seems to get stronger and stronger as you go to becoming an eighth grader. But no kid, there's no such thing really as an average kid. It turns out these dynamics are radically different depending on what kind of context you're in. So if you're in a high achieving school that's doing quite well in terms of mathematics, you might see something like on the right. If you're in a low performing school that's struggling with mathematics, you might see something on the left. So the development of this fundamental cognitive ability that might be involved in sort of really getting into the building of conceptualizations of number is really taking off quite differently in schools. And this might be something that we could explore and address and understand better. And it might also be linked to other factors. This is correlational research, so we have to do large exploration. It could be related to things like poverty, things like the overall environment and how it's inducing change and development and growth in the children. We also explored this more in other children, children that were struggling, children in poverty, and we found something very similar in which enumeration of grouping cues was the biggest predictor of algebraic reasoning, even though the tasks were done a year apart. So we're starting to get confident about this and decide that we're going to be very bold and put this into our crosswalk between ABCD and the CETA data set. So now we're inserting this task into over 10,000 kids' laptops and getting this data from the entire cohort of ABCD and getting some beautiful data here. The data across years 3, 5, and 7, you can just see these beautiful population curves emerge, and you can see how a little bit of cognition, like the grouping cue, can literally move mountains in terms of the distributions here. And you can see how experience is accumulating. Kids are getting better and better at each of the tasks, but we're seeing more action in the grouping. We're also seeing that cross-year stability is much greater for groupitizing than random, so we're discovering these pretty cool things. Another thing that we're starting to do is put this in context of two different dimensions of schooling. One is your overall school's performance, which is correlated with your neighborhoods and your parent, the community SES, but another seems to be really quite school-specific, and that is the degree in which children are gaining, the percent they're gaining from year to year from 3 to 8th grade. Some kids are in schools in which they're gaining only 80% of a grade level every year, 3rd to 8th grade. Other kids in school are gaining 130% of a grade level every year. And this doesn't seem to be directly tied to SES quite as powerfully. It seems to be much more of a school-specific property. So we've been exploring this to see in the groupitizing psychometric performance how this plays out, and we see the really, really large effects across the nation for how many items per minute a child can complete for groupitizing, depending on the qualities of their school. That might be related to a whole bunch of stuff that's going on, but there might be some things that are really quite specifically related to the school, like this growth factor. And we see that these children who are starting off at the very same level of performance in 3rd grade are diverging quite dramatically over the course of the year 5 and year 7. And we can explore that as well to see how this is playing out. This is the average function for that. In kind of really well-achieving schools that are associated with higher SES, we see that curve kind of collapse entirely and not really make much difference. But then we see a hugely exaggerated curve for the schools that are struggling with resources, which means two things that I think are my take-home points that I'm gonna wrap up here. One is that these children might be at a multiplicative risk factor for really, really struggling with gaining mathematics. And these children might be a source of information about how, what are the factors of resilience that are causing this level of performance by the end, even though they're in a context which is, you know, overall kind of biasing them towards having trouble. I do want to tease that one of the great things about putting this in the context of ABCD is that we can now relate this to the resting state connectivity of every single child that was collected when they were just 9 years old. And then we can look at how that predicts their performance 4 years into the future on a math test, on a groupitizing test, on things like this. And we're starting to see some really interesting results in these very rigorous kind of controlled validation arm studies in which we come up with a set of features in the connectome that if you measure them when the child is 9 years of age, and then you come back and find that kid 4 years later and test them on mathematics and groupitizing, there are some features that load very, very heavily on the frontoparietal network we've been hearing about. And most interestingly, if you train these networks on their symbolic, on their non-symbolic dot enumeration, those vectors that we pull out of that trained model are actually doing a pretty good job of predicting their symbolic arithmetic. So these might be really important cross-modal connectome features that are really showing us the conceptual overlap between the symbolic and the non-symbolic world. And I'll stop on the point that I believe that one really powerful form of education for children in math and number is when they learn to integrate all of their intuitions and understandings and affordances of the non-symbolic world with all of the affordances of the symbolic world. I think this is a very powerful form of learning, and I think that we can start to use some of these techniques to show the neural principles that might guide that. So with that, I'm gonna stop and thank you, and also to thank Stan for an inspiring 30 years of friendship, inspiration, and just a fantastic moment of awe that I'm having right now.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.